The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to our makeshift studio here in Boston, Thomas Berger. He is the Professor of International Relations at Boston University. Thomas, a real pleasure, and thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
We might start with your title, so International Relations. How profound or otherwise a reset of international relations are we experiencing, living through at the moment?
Well, we will have to see, of course, but we are seeing some rather dramatic developments, ones which are really shaking to the core the set of institutional arrangements that have undergirded and underlain, been the foundations for international relations for about 80 years.
Why is it happening? And I mean that more kind of beyond the because Donald Trump wills it. You know, what are the currents maybe that are directing Donald Trump's decision making?
Well, I mean, in terms of the development of the international order, I mean, there are two things before we get to the Donald himself. But one is that the international politics itself is evolving, and there's a shift in the distribution of power. Above all, it's the rise of China, which has now become the world's second largest economy, which has tremendous dynamism and which has something of a chip on its shoulder. China feels like it has been set upon by outside powers for well over 100 years. They refer to it as the century of humiliation, going back to the opium wars of the 1839. And they seek to set it right and reclaim China's rightful place in the international order. Xi Jinping of China refers to it as the resurrection or the of the great Chinese nation. Along with that, is Russia is back as well under Vladimir Putin. And Putin also seeks to...
I'm sorry. I'm just going to cut across you because... white smoke has just billowed out.
Well, congratulations.
of the Sistine Chapel. So the cardinals have elected a new pope. So the successor to St. Francis, the successor to St. Peter, as they say, has been selected. We don't know who he is yet. We won't know who he is for some time yet. It can take up to an hour before the Pope appears in the balcony of St. Peter's, and Habemus Papam is the declaration that will precede his appearance. But we have the white smoke, and we will have to wait and see exactly who it is. As soon as there is anything happening there, we will go live straight to Vatican City to find out exactly who it is. But like I say, white smoke. So there is a new Pope, but Schrodinger's Pope for the moment, because they know who he is inside the room. We don't know who he is outside the room. So the bells of the Vatican, the bells of St. Peter's, the bells right across Rome, I'm sure, pealing as we speak. So listen, that's exciting, even if you have no interest from a religious point of view, but from the point of view of common cultural experience, something big has just happened. So anyway, listen, like I say, we will go back to Vatican City in just a moment. Thomas, apologies there to cut across
you. No problem. I can't pretend to compete with that.
Yeah, well, listen, it is. Isn't it funny? Sorry, I know this is slightly off topic. You know, for all the talk about the tide going out in terms of people's religious adoration when it comes to the church, it is this common cultural touchstone. We have a reporter there, and he says there's Anglicans and there's Jews and there's Muslims, and they're all gathered around because everyone else is watching it.
Well, I mean, the church continues to play a large role in the world and commands attention, no doubt.
Yeah. So listen, white smoke from the Vatican. And we will wait and see. I think when Cardinal Ratzinger was selected and he ultimately became Pope Benedict, it was quite a short turnaround. It was maybe 15-20 minutes. That's German efficiency for you, though. So I'm not sure if there's a German as a front runner this time. It might be up to an hour. But anyway, as soon as it happens, we'll bring it to you. Anyway, back to what we were talking about, which is the Chinese reemergence and the Russians.
What I was trying to say is that some of the underlying, if you like, plate tectonics of the international system shifted. China and Russia in particular have been dissatisfied with the particular international order led by the United States for a while. And they're joined by other, shall we say, malcontents or countries which are dissatisfied with this order. North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, and they have formed what some people call the axis of authoritarianism, and they have been intent upon challenging this international order. And the United States nonetheless felt that it could handle. We faced these kinds of challenges before, and we thought that with our help, with our friends, that is we, when I say American leaders and the larger policymaking community, thought that with the help of our friends and allies in Europe and in Asia, we would be able to meet this challenge. But what has happened in addition to that is some rather profound and important changes in American domestic politics. These are the same changes that we're seeing also in parts of Europe. That is, many people, especially people in the working class, feel that the international order, and especially the international trading order, the sort of globalized economy, yeah, which has been emerged over the last 30, 40 years, is not working for them. And they have been turning to populist leaders, people like Donald Trump in the United States, Marie Le Pen in France, the leaders, Alice Weidel and the leaders of the AfD, the Alternative for Germany in Germany. And they are believe in having a very different approach. They are critical of this international order, beginning with the international trading order.
And what's their vision of the international order as they see it, as it should be? You know, what ultimately do the Donald Trumps and the Marine Le Pens and the Viktor Orbans of this world imagine the world should look like from an international cooperation point of view if it's not what we've gotten used to for the last 40 years?
Well, it's a little bit inchoate and unclear at this moment, but different people have different visions. But I think the main point which they have in common is the belief that the nation, however you want to define it, you know, the people of a particular place, a particular country, a particular history, should be at the center of foreign policy. And they feel that there has been too much emphasis on cooperation. They believe that the type of cooperation which we have has largely benefited a globalized elite, the so-called Davos man, the type of people who would show up at international conferences like the regular meeting of the rich and the mighty in the ski resort in Switzerland. They believe in taking their country back, and they want to redefine international politics along those lines, a much more nationalist line. Now, in different places, that means different things, but in the context of the United States, and I should add that, you know, there are different groups inside of the Trump administration with different ideas, but it basically means that we're going to pull back from our international commitments, including international security commitments that we've had up to now.
Yeah, and I don't want to be dismissive of those concerns, because, you know, they're real, that sense of disenfranchisement and, yes, a sense of the concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands. And, you know, the evaporation of the American dream maybe here, and the breaking of the social contract is how we might describe it at home. At the same time, that cooperation has led to a kind of a profoundly safe world. Certainly our parts of the world, and Europe has kind of enjoyed this Pax Europa for an awful long time. And one wonders whether we might look back on that as something of an aberration, and actually the world might be getting more dangerous.
Well, there's no perfect normality and there's no complete aberration. I mean, you know, things are in flux. I think that basically the approach of these sort of nationalist populist figures is based upon a profound misunderstanding of how things work. I mean, I'm going to back up for a second and simply say something about how America and the United States has basically viewed international politics, the sort of guiding assumptions for the last 80 years. You know, from the beginning of the founding of the American Republic, here in Boston is one of the birthplaces of the American Revolution, so it's an appropriate place to talk about this. But, you know, from the beginning, there was a feeling that the United States should pull back. America first was for a long time the guiding principle of U.S. foreign policy. We believe that insulated from world politics by our two great oceans, we should be focusing upon our economic development, upon the perfecting of our republic, of our society. And this was famously, you know, reflected in George Washington's farewell address, that America should avoid entangling alliances. That was the guiding principle for American foreign policy for well over 100 years. Now, what happened is in the first half of the 20th century, that set of ideas was profoundly challenged. The United States, in some ways, became too large to be ignored. It had become, by the 1900, the United States represented pretty much what it still represents today, someplace between 20 and 25% of global GDP. And while we might profess that we are not interested in international politics was interested in us. We had no way of staying out of the great conflicts of the world because we would, in the context of the First World War, we got pulled in, right, by basically siding with the Western allies. And this led to unrestricted submarine warfare, the sinking of the Lusitania, Germany reaching out to both Japan and Mexico, the Zimmermann telegram, all of these things I don't need to go into. Mm. But, you know, it became very clear that Germany was becoming hostile to us. Before the Second World War, once again, we tried to stay out. We retreated into an isolationist position. American leaders at that time actually used the phrase America first. We, of course, became sympathetic, as Japan in particular, but also Germany was expanding their respective spheres of influence in Europe and Asia. We increasingly became involved on the British side, on the Chinese Republican side in China, and this led the Japanese to try to take us out, Pearl Harbor and all that. Well, these two experiences then convinced American foreign policymakers, and the broader American public was willing to go along with this, that this traditional stance of isolationism, of trying to focus only on our own security, was simply not going to work. And we decided then to create this system of alliances undergirded by a practice, you know, set of, you know, foreign policy and also a trade and economic relations, which worked for us for 80 years. Yeah? Our victory in the Cold War was sort of proof positive, the proof of concept. I mean, we fought the long twilight struggle of the Soviet Union. We saw it off. And remarkably, in 1989, the Russians cried Vanya, or whatever the Russian equivalent of uncle is, right?
Yes.
And, you know, American foreign policymakers, including people like Marco Rubio, the current Secretary of State, probably are continuing to operate with that, shall we say, set of ideas.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Trump comes in. He does not have that understanding. A large segment of the American population is likewise dissatisfied with how things have been going, and they're overturning the apple cart.
Right. Well, the overturning of the apple cart, who knows where it brings us. Thomas, it's been a real pleasure.
All right, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks a million. Really insightful. Thomas Berger is Professor of International Relations at Boston University.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.